You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hey, y'all. Spooky season is here. And if you're looking for a show to whet your appetite for a little haunted history, then I'd like to invite you to check out Southern Gothic, a chart-topping history podcast that explores some of the most infamous legends, folklore, ghost stories, and hauntings of the American South. We've covered all sorts of stuff from the Bell Witch of Tennessee to the disappearance of the Confederate submarine, the H.L. Hunley, not to mention our deep dives into the local lore of some of America's oldest and most haunted cities, like New Orleans, Charleston, and St. Augustine. So, if you're ready for a little good old-fashioned Halloween storytelling with a commitment to quality historical research, then be sure to check out Southern Gothic today. It's available now on all your favorite podcast apps.
Monster House presents
Monster Talk is an independent podcast production of Monster House, LLC. You can show your support by subscribing to our ad-free extended episodes at patreon.com/monstertalk. We want to grow our Monster Talk audience, and the easiest way to accomplish that is for listeners to leave us 5-star reviews on iTunes. Positive reviews have a huge impact and only take a moment.
It's Paris, 1897. The Eiffel Tower has only been open for 8 years. We're in the heart of the Belle Epoque, the period of peace and explosive innovation in Parisian art between the late 1870s and the start of the Great War in 1914. It's also a time of what the French call the fin du siècle, the end period of the century. A dance called the Can-Can is making the Moulin Rouge nightclub the talk of Europe. Marie Curie is newly married, and she and her husband Pierre are conducting experiments that will lead to the discovery of radium. Robert W. Chambers' story collection, The King in Yellow, has been out for less than 2 years and is thrilling English readers with its weird stories of the supernatural, mixed in with dramatic and transgressive tales of French art students and the relationships they have with their models. Claude Monet began his series of water lily paintings this year. And Oscar Wilde, fresh out of English prison, has moved to France and begins writing The Ballad of Reading Jail. It's a time of innovation and new technology, but experimentation also spreads to the stage. A new kind of theatrical experience is emerging, one which tries to create extremely realistic slices of life. The sets are composed of secondhand furniture meant to evoke a kind of realism, perhaps similar to the way we today see high-definition videos. And a few blocks away from the red windmilled nightclub, down a dead-end alleyway, behind an entrance that was clearly once a church, a very new kind of experience is unfolding on the stage. Comedy? Yes. Drama? Of course. But then, something else. Imagine you're in the audience. You've had some laughs. You've seen some melodrama. These brief little plays are delightful and efficient. But then this new story starts, and it seems so familiar. Why? What is it about that girl and her family? She's just like that girl in that news story you read last week. Oh, no. No, no, no. But that girl ended up so horribly. Wait. Oh, they can't show this, can they? Because in that news story, what happened to her? Oh, no, they would never. Welcome to the Grand Guignol, the experimental Parisian theater that tried out many innovations, but became famous for one particular thing, terrorizing the audiences with its incredible displays of staged violence, to the point that its name has literally become an adjective.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
Today we're going to be hearing from Professor Richard Hand, who's going to talk to us about the Grand Guignol, the Paris theater that strongly and directly influenced horror and terror for decades, and whose influence extends far beyond the little building that housed the company and gave stage to terrors night after night. Be sure and check out the books by Professor Hand and his writing partner, Michael Wilson. Links to that will be in our show notes.
Monster Talk.
All right. Welcome to Monster Talk, Dr. Richard Hand. Dr. Hand, you are the professor of media practice at the University of East Anglia, if my research is correct.
That's correct. Yeah.
And you've written extensively on horror and pop culture, including looks at TV, movies, radio, and stage plays. And you've also written and directed numerous plays yourself. And you have multiple books out on the topic that we want to talk about this week, which is one that's been bouncing around in my head for years. I didn't know how to engage on it, but that's the Paris theater known as the Grand Guignol. And I'm probably slaughtering that, but if you can help us say it right,
I think
that'll
we
be
all
awesome.
Will. And yeah. no one wants to hear an Australian pronounce anything in French. So,
well, like,
Guignol, I think, is the best we can do.
I'm sure the Grand Guignol would be very proud of your slaughtering.
Yep.
I think they would.
Exactly.
Indeed, yeah.
I'm sure copious theater blood is pouring out of people's ears at hearing my attempt.
Yeah.
So I came across your work while I was actually, I wanted to do an episode on this topic, and I did some research myself, but I was feeling a bit inadequate. And like literally maybe an hour before we were getting ready to record, I found your work and I was like, whoa, I can't even approach this topic. You've done so much more research on it and I would gather even practice within it.
Yeah, he canceled the interview and left me at the altar. And here we are now.
So a great deal of drama, but here we are. Exactly. So I guess there's a real chance that a lot of our audience may have never even heard of this before. I think I first came across it as an adjective, not as a noun. And so what is this? What is the Grand Guignol?
It's a fantastic term, isn't it, that's entered the language. I mean, to this day, you'll read a review of a new horror movie or the latest series of American Horror Story, and some reviewer will say, oh, it's so Grand Guignol. And so it entered the language, and it's actually a very specific kind of route to it, which was a little theatre in Paris, literally up a kind of dead-end street in a sleazy area of Paris, which was called the Théâtre du Grand Guignol. And it was an extraordinary venue. It established itself in 1897, which is the same year that Dracula is published across the English Channel. And so a big year for horror in Europe. And it started, it didn't set out to be a horror theatre. It was a kind of a venue for realist plays, short realist plays, which were the kind of all the vogue in kind of artistic experimentation in France at the time. So it was a very small venue because it was a deconsecrated chapel. So already an incredible venue. And they just presented short plays. And these plays were like a snapshot of real life. They were like holding a mirror up to the audience, which was incredibly radical at that moment. And then in the first sort of performances, there was one play called Mademoiselle Fifi, in which a French prostitute murders a Prussian soldier, a Prussian officer. And that was the one everyone was talking about. So they'd seen five or six plays that night, but everyone was saying, you've got to go just to see that play, if nothing else. And the owners of the Grand Guignol realised, well, we wanted to do Slice of Life, but actually it was our Slice of Death play.
Yeah.
That has got the audience.
That was a Guy Maupassant, based on his short story, wasn't it? Mademoiselle Fifi.
That's it. Yeah, so classic bit of realist French fiction that they'd adapted. And it was the one people saying, God, you know, seeing it with real actors and everything, amazing. And that was it. That kind of cast the die. And one thing that's interesting, even though it became this legendary theatre of horror right through to when it closed in the early 60s, it was always a realist theatre. So their kind of horror, they were not interested in the supernatural. But for us now, this is so interesting, isn't it? It's that whole subgenre of horror, which is the slasher movie, which is the serial killer. That was the kind of thing, because they were still holding up a mirror to the audience saying, this stuff happens, guys, when you leave the theatre, be careful.
But I'm just curious, this is going off track a little bit, but I'm curious about a deconsecrated church. I've never really heard of that. I've certainly heard of places becoming consecrated, but I've never heard of deconsecrating a place.
Yeah.
Do you know anything about that, Richard, the process and what's done?
Well, it was an 18th century chapel, a small little chapel. And then, it just was stopped being used as a chapel. So it became this big empty space. Well, not so big. It was a very small venue. But then obviously when the founder of the Grand Guignol, Oscar Metenier, was looking for a place to build his little theatre, the opportunity came up to get this empty chapel. The amazing thing is he did very little to the inside. So these amazing photographs that we're lucky enough to have of the inside, you can see there were still these 10-foot tall angels in the rafters carved out of wood. And, you know, the apparently audiences who went said you could still smell, 200 years of incense and wax. And the thing is, when it became the theatre of horror, can you imagine turning away, averting your eyes from the shock on the stage to see a disapproving angel staring at you and getting that smell of the incense and the candle wax. So it was like before the show started, there was something evocative. And you can imagine people thinking they're saying, this was once a holy place, but it isn't anymore.
Yeah, it's like the inverse. But that idea of the deconsecrated church, it's the underlying premise of that song, Alice's Restaurant, right? That's all happening in a church being turned into a house. And then in Atlanta, we've got this really beautiful music venue called the Tabernacle downtown in Atlanta, which is used to be a big church. And it still sort of has a lot of that feel to it. But, definitely not churchy sort of things going on there.
That's right. Those venues were great auditoriums, weren't they?
Yes.
They were designed for singing, for music, for big speeches. And so, the acoustics were there. That was already a kind of ideal space. But I just think it's amazing with the Grand Guignol. It was a happy accident, really. But in a way, it sets the paradigm, doesn't it, for future haunted attractions and, the haunted mansion at Disney or whatever. Yeah. As you go in and you look around you, the show's beginning,
Exactly. It's setting your expectations or kind of, from a psychological perspective, it's priming you for the experience.
And another thing quite interesting in that regard, I mentioned Oscar Metenier, and he, apparently when audiences were queuing up to go in, when it became really popular, he would be dressed in black and he'd be in the alleyway outside talking to the people queuing up. And his day job was he was secretary to the police force in Paris. So he would be telling them some of the stories. Oh, you heard about that murder? Well, I can tell you even more what the newspapers didn't tell you. And so it was all this kind of horror host stuff. Again, it really is indicating the kind of wonderful stuff that's going to happen later. The kind of man in black host. Fantastic.
Monster Talk is brought to you by BetterHelp. Is there something preventing you from achieving your own goals? Are you having mental health challenges?
You're talking to me?
Oh.
You're talking about me?
This is all about you, Karen.
I think there's something preventing me from achieving my goal, and I think it's me. So.
Oh, well, We are the enemy within. We're the ones we can't stop from undermining our own plans and our hopes and our dreams. You can't escape you. But what you can do is hopefully find ways to navigate around your own limitations and hang-ups.
Yeah, we're born free, but everywhere we're in chains, right?
That's right, yeah.
This business is just such an exciting and innovative new idea because it kind of circumvents having to be in a doctor's office, having to deal with the secretary and other people in the waiting room, because you can instead schedule weekly video or phone sessions, and you can even talk to someone via text. And that's so cool to me. That's the way the world is going.
It's something that we all know can be a challenge or an issue. And sometimes it's hard to overcome stigma associated with mental health issues. But this is so great because it's private, discreet. It's licensed professionals. You just go to the website, sign up, and they will give you a little questionnaire that guides you through to get you to the kind of help that you need. And they deal with all kinds of mental health challenges.
I think it's something that we can all do to have some help with, because I don't think that there's any shame in talking to someone. And sure, you can talk to friends and family, but there are some things that you just want to keep confidential, and it's good to get an outside perspective.
I mean, if you have relationship trouble or depression, stress and anxiety, or if you're having family conflicts, a lot of these kind of issues, you can't talk to your family, or maybe you don't want to talk to your friends because you're afraid of what they'll think of you. But you can talk to a professional counselor, a licensed professional counselor. It's all discreet. It's done securely. You can use video conferencing or texting, and you don't have to wait in a waiting room. It's just a fantastic aid for people in a time when we probably need it more than ever.
Absolutely. And I think it's great, too, that it's available. The service is available for everyone around the world. So it's not just us in the States. It's also people in England and Canada and Australia and New Zealand. So it's just accessible to everyone.
Now, it is affordable and convenient, but as a listener to Monster Talk, you can get 10% off of your first month of support by visiting our sponsor at betterhelp.com/Monster Talk.
There are already 1 million people who are using this service. So again, that's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Monster Talk.
Thank you.
So I had a follow-up. I've read about people entering the building and that there's the smell of candles and wax and incense, and people likened it to walking into a tomb. And I've also heard that sometimes that they had a leaky roof, and when water would come through the roof, that people would think that the building was leaking blood in the middle of the plays, and that really added to the atmosphere.
That's right. I think it's just fantastic, isn't it? And you know, here we are in the sort of season of Halloween, and you know, that's the kind of thing you'd want with a haunted attraction or something, isn't it? Use the building to its advantage. Yeah. And many years ago, myself and my co-author, Mike Wilson, we went with a group of our students up to the Edinburgh Festival. And we had a choice of venues that we could do our horror show in. And one venue was a church crypt at midnight. And we said, yeah, we'll have that one. Thank you very much.
Wow, that's cool.
Okay. So I wanted to, and if you'll pardon me, I do have a tendency towards puns, but I just want to set the stage for our audience, because they may not be able to put themselves in the mindset easily of a theater goer at this time. There's no radio, there's no motion pictures. So how does theater at that time sort of compare to our forms of entertainment today?
Yeah, really good question that. And I mean, I think that was part of the effect of it, was part of this sort of realist revolution that was going on, certainly in French culture and spreading across Europe, where people had had enough of kind of historical drama and melodrama and all these things. They wanted, you know, art that was about the real world and real life, you know, realism with a capital R. And, you know, as you said, there was no radio, TV, but there were newspapers, and the Grand Guignol used a lot of true stories from newspapers as the basis. And I just love the idea of an audience sat watching a play, and then when they realise what it's about, going, oh my God, this is true, this happened. Or, you know, I was just reading about this, and these gruesome crimes of revenge or murder, and they see it there with glorious stage blood and all the rest. So, you know, and that must have built a cult around it. I mean, it became extremely popular. especially it had a kind of local audience who would go and see plays again and again. And I think they took great pleasure in going with someone who hadn't seen it, who hadn't seen the jump scares. So they're doing that. But also tourists were going along as well. And it just had this kind of reputation. And especially when it was doing topical plays, some of them about, you know, really notorious incidents. And it was a chance for people to go and see it. You know, we might look up something on YouTube or whatever now. But people then, you know, this was their chance to see it happen before their eyes, these horrible things that happened in real life.
There is something special about those live shows, I tell you. I went to see the Book of Mormon being performed and with my wife a few years back. And at one point, a character on stage is killed. And I remember someone screaming, "Jesus Christ," at the point that happened. And then I remember a sharp pain in my ribs because I was being elbowed by my wife because it was me that had shouted that.
I can imagine that.
Actually, Blake, that's a really interesting point, you know, mentioning Book of Mormon, because the Grongedale was a theatre of comedy as well. Now, this is easy to forget because the legend is the theatre of horror, the theatre of terror and all the rest. But they never did whole-length plays. They always did the short plays. And they interspersed horror with comedy. Now, when I've recreated this kind of thing, you can see the effect because you can do all the horrible stuff in one play and then you have a damn good laugh in a comedy. And then you're back in with horror. But of course, like any horror movie or whatever, the use of comedy where you get your audience laughing is so mischievous because you're making them put their guard down. You're making them relax. And then, boy, do you really hit them with the next thing. So I love the idea that people think, oh, I can breathe easy now. This is a comedy. But it was all just to get them ready, primed for the next shock.
Okay. Didn't they call those hot and cold showers?
That's right. Yeah, yeah. The douche écossaise, the Scottish shower, the hot and cold shower, and interspersing it. But I do think, you know, looking at horror movies now, you know, that some of those best bits, especially, you know, if you're in a crowded movie house or whatever, and those fantastic bits where there's a false alarm, you know, and it's the cat jumping on the bed or something like that, which makes people jump and then everybody laughs and that kind of comic moment. Or even, you know, quite developed comedy, even in horror films. It's a devious technique, isn't it? It's that roller coaster.
So how does this compare? I'm trying to think of, like, what were the stage effects in this theater like compared to the sort of things you would see in a, you know, a Shakespeare play where someone's stabbed? I mean, like, how radically different are these sort of horror plays or terror? Maybe terror is a better word. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great question, Blake, actually. I mean, I think, you know, we had high melodrama, and certainly in France, there's these wonderful blood and thunder melodramas, they called them. And there were plays like Lucretia Borgia by Victor Hugo, which has got this huge death count in it, and people are stabbed and poisoned and all the rest. But it's almost operatic. Whereas I think what was amazing with the Grand Guignol was the realism, and that extended to special effects. And there was a genius there called Paul Ratineau who developed, you know, the legend goes, he developed stage blood that would congeal. So audience would, you know, see it congeal in front of them. And amazing effects for eye gouging and, you know, guillotining and all of that. Drawing a lot on stage magic, actually, that sleight of hand and misdirection. But actually doing very, very realistic effects. And that had a huge impact on people. So I think, yeah, you say, you know, the Shakespearean stuff, you know, may have been a bit of red ribbon for blood and whatever, and very heightened deaths and people, you know, saying, oh, my God, he got me, and all the kind of melodramatic speeches. But the Grand Guignol was sometimes something so shocking about the realism of it and the suddenness of some of these effects, which would make the audience gasp, yeah.
So I've heard that there were over 1,000 plays which took place there, and I think actual plays themselves, not performances. But I wonder if you could give us some examples of some of the plots of some of the plays which were shown there, because I've heard about ones. I mean, aside from the comedy, it seems like a lot of them do involve torture and gore and shock and things like that, and often involving, as you were saying, stabbing people and taking out their eyes. I've also read that there was a local confectioner who would make eyeballs for the theatre, and they would go through those, many of those every day. But yeah, I wonder if you could tell us about some of the plots of some of the plays that were performed.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, as I was saying earlier, some of them are based on news stories. And so, I mean, there were some fantastic kind of jilted lover stories. And there's one called The Final Kiss, which I think is a masterpiece, really, because it opens with a man who's been disfigured by a sulfuric acid attack when he left his girlfriend. And he's, you know, he's all wrapped up in bandages, and he's requested just to see her, to say he forgives her. And already the audience is thinking, oh, yeah, really? That's the most wonderful cat and mouse. And then at the end of the play, he does it to her, what she did to him. Oh, and of course, with the Grand Guignol effect, the smoke, the melting face, the screams of the actress, absolutely amazing. You know, and that was a play that was revived quite frequently.
Ooh, acid appealing to our base instincts. Nice. Little chemistry joke.
Yes, that's right. So they had plays like that. They had one called the Ultimate Torture, which was about the Boxer Rebellion, and it was about the siege of the French legation, which rather like an embassy. And so this was a true story. People that had read about the Western powers had all, you know, all their various consulates and things like that had been under siege by a rebellion. And, you know, so this was only a couple of years after the actual thing happened. And so people could go and watch the horror and deprivation of what was happening there. People with their hands chopped off and things like that. But when you think about it, it's literally just 2 years later or something, you know, again, it's, you know,
too soon.
Five equivalents. Yeah. I mean, that's it. They wouldn't have held back. And I think, you know, looking through subsequent history and true horrible events, you know, they would have set a play in the Twin Towers on the 100th floor or something. You know, this is the sort of thing the Grand Guignol would do and say, here you go, watch this.
Yeah. And that play has, like really strong dramatic irony. It's not really the same sort of theme, but it reminds me very much of the ending of the movie The Mist. It's just like, wow, things haven't changed that much. I mean, you know what I mean?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, that it's incredible, isn't it? Yeah, that it really is that paradigm, even though it's from 1904 or something.
Yeah.
And there's one I really like as well called The Haunted House, which is, again, from the very beginning of the 20th century. And it's about a group of kind of pleasure-seeking, you know, middle-class people who know about this kind of empty house, and there's rumours that it's haunted. And they go in, and you get all the language of the Gothic, and you're reading it thinking, hey, the Grand Guignol's going to go supernatural with this one. But then you find out the house, you know, is occupied, not by ghosts, but there's a guy who's trapped his wife there and is torturing her. And it really is a kind of torture porn narrative from 1907 or whatever. It's absolutely extraordinary, you know, when all that language of the Gothic is shown to be absolutely, and you wish it was a ghost because it's so horrifying what is going on, you know, in this kind of locked in the basement of this house, you know, absolutely amazing, you know, kind of ahead of its time. And they did similar. There's one play from around 1902, which is called Au Téléphone, so on the telephone. And in that, you know, a guy, he's having dinner with friends and he's saying, oh, we're also, you know, they're kind of yuppie kind of characters saying, we've got telephones. Everyone respectable has got a telephone. I'll just phone home and see how my wife and baby are. And he phones up and he hears them getting murdered at the end of the line. He's powerless because he's miles away. And it's kind of, yeah, we kind of recognize the trope. But when you think it's 1902, you know, and the use of telephone directly for horror is casting a long shadow. And what I love about that play, no blood, no nothing, because he's just describing what's happening. So it relied on really good acting. So no special effects needed. But I bet you audience came out imagining they'd seen it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Psychological thriller.
Yeah.
So I have heard stories about boxes that they had in the audience, and I think I've heard in some versions that they were the confessionals left behind from when the place was a church, and about people renting them out or using them as hotel rooms. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, this is you've got to love Paris, haven't you? Yeah, there were these little booths that you could, they were grilled booths, so rather like a confessional. Yeah, you could draw the screen up or down or where, however it worked. So you'd have a bit of privacy. And so, you know, two or possibly three people would go into those and have a bit of fun. And the actors did say sometimes things would break down. You know, they had to say, can you keep it quiet in there, please? We're trying to do a play here, you know. But on a more serious note, I mean, it says something. There is something very titillating about the Grand Guignol. I think there's something titillating about horror. But, you know, this was the main theatre, really, in the Pigalle Montmartre district. There was the Moulin Rouge there. There were a hell of a lot of brothels. There was all of that kind of entertainment. But this was the theatre, and it wasn't in the theatre district. But I think some people have had a taste for stage blood and had a taste for some of the S&M kind of stuff there. This is where they'd go and get their kicks.
So some people were turned on going to view these plays, but I've heard that other people would faint or vomit and that they had doctors and nurses on hand to treat audience members if they were affected by the performances.
That's right. Kind of in the 1920s, in its real heyday, when they had some major stars there and everything, they would have the kind of house doctor and nurses. And I think, you know, I don't know how medically qualified these guys were, but it was you know, in an era before William Castle does the same kind of thing. Brilliant idea to have, you know, a doctor in attendance. And it became, you know, this kind of part of the folklore. And certainly when we've recreated Grand Guignol, we've sometimes done that. And it just works a dream because the audience find it hilarious. Having a doctor or nurse as you're going in say, can I just take your pulse? Because you look a little frail to me. And then picking on, and what we tell actors is, you know, let everyone sit down and then go back to someone again saying, look, we're really worried about you or, you know, target someone else. And I think it just builds up that frisson, doesn't it? It gets the audience giggling, laughing, getting into it, laughing at each other. So there was this kind of legend about a number of people fainting, including the doctor sometimes. You know, this was a great one, but I'm afraid you can't have the doctor. He's fainted too.
Yeah.
Would people leave as well? Leave the performances in disgust?
I haven't found documentation of that, but it can be provocative, you know, and I know seeing modern horror theatre, it can have that effect. And I've seen modern Grand Guignol recreations where people just like, I've reached my limit, I've got to go.
Right.
But sometimes interesting, people go, they go to the bar and then, hey, it's the comedy, I'm going back in, you know. So it's interesting playing with that boundary, you know, where, how far people dare to go.
Right.
I remember, this is just thinking about theatre, the people leaving. My friend in college went to go see Dawn of the Dead, the one in the shopping mall. It was at a midnight theater type showing, and there were other like midnight comedies and shows on, and they had filled up. And so there were like people, I went all the way to the movies, I guess I'll go see this, not knowing what it was. And so my friend, he rolled in, you know, 10 minutes or so before the show, was like, why are all these people here? I expected, you know, a dozen. And it was like really crowded. And, it, you know, if you've watched Dawn of the Dead, you know, it quickly turns into a very thematically similar sort of situation where they're way over the top violence. And by the time they get to the sort of famous scene where they're in the tenement house and one of the zombies bites his wife's neck, it was just three people left. It's like just, and I just always loved that idea of like, you know, can I endure it? Just watching people give up and leave and give up and leave. Oh,
I left the Blair Witch, project or whatever it was called. Was it Blair Witch Project or just Blair Witch?
Yeah.
I can't remember. I left that. I went to a midnight screening of it.
Screaming.
And I had to leave halfway through and screaming. I had to leave. It wasn't because of fear. It was just eye strain.
Mm-hmm.
I was sitting right down the front and just with all of the way that they filmed everything, I could not tolerate it. And I had to go and take a break for about 10 minutes before going back.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about, the stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or say, Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like I've seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose. It kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand and probably won't understand.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinwagPod and Wagon.
I've got one interesting story actually about kind of with modern Grand Guignol. And there was one show in Liverpool in England with a horror company that worked there. And it was a fascinating moment because they did one play and the audience, it was packed house. Again, small venue, you know, ideal for the Grand Guignol. That's intimate, works best. But when the subject became apparent what the play was about, several people left because it was about a recent notorious paedophile case. And it was a celebrity one. There was a guy in Britain called Jimmy Savile who's notorious paedophile. It became clear after his death. And it was amazing because the audience, they didn't storm out and slam the door. They crept out and they were waiting outside. Right. And they wanted to apologise to the company to say, the show's brilliant, but I just couldn't do it. I could not. When I realised what this next 25 minutes was going to be about, I couldn't do it. Right. And so it's that amazing kind of tension it creates, you know, where the show is going on in the auditorium as much as on the stage.
Sure.
They
were brave doing it. They knew it would be provocative. But again, you know, that's the spirit of the Grand Guignol. It's the kind of thing they would have done. You know, I'm thinking of notorious stories the world over in the States and Europe last few years. You know, the Grand Guignol would have been in there writing about that, you know.
Yeah, I think it's I'm always tempted to draw parallels between this kind of thing and the motion picture business. And I'm sure we'll talk about that overall. But, you know, the things like in the 1970s, especially Italian cinema, sort of experimenting with there was the giallos and then the whole Mondo sort of things. And you know, everybody, it was so edgy. Everybody's always thinking, wait, is this real? Is it a snuff film? You know, obviously it's not. At some level, you know, these performers are going to be doing another performance in an hour and a half or whatever, you know, so, but yet it seems real or it feels real to the audience at the time. It's a very visceral thing. And I think it's something we've talked about on the show before is that sort of how horror and terror, these sort of fictional portrayals gives us a way to sort of process those feelings without the full risk, you know, like the full risk of experiencing them ourselves.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Is this something you explore in your work? I mean, is it something you as a professor, do you talk about that sort of the psychological side, or is it more about the drama side, or like what?
Yeah, we do talk about the psychology of it. I mean, it's quite interesting because sometimes when I'm working with students or young professional actors wanting to work on the Grand Guignol, you know, we're having a look at it. We're reading some of the old scripts. We're having a bit of a laugh, saying, "Oh my God, so cheesy!" You know, so old fashioned. And then I say, "Okay, well, how would we update this? What are we scared of? What strikes a nerve with us?" And then you begin to see it. And the amazing thing is the old Grand Guignol plays, the formula is brilliant. You know, they are that thrill ride, I think. They've got such great structure. They know how to build things up and then let you down. Build it up, you get a laugh because it's a false alarm. And then wham, you know. And so we can use that formula, even though sometimes the plot or the surface is a bit different to it. So that can be quite amazing. One thing I say as well with working with actors is, and I've found doing productions, it's enormous fun to put together, and it's got to be, because sometimes you're taking on the stage in the stories, you're going to some very weird, nasty places, and you've got to have trust. You've got to have a damn good laugh as a team. You know, because, you know, and it's really important to know how to to let your hair down. And I think when I've spoken to other horror companies, they agree, you know, that there's something really special about building the ensemble who are working on Grand Guignol, because you're a family, because in a way you've got to be, you know.
How long were these shows? If they're doing multiple plays in a night, what is your ticket getting you entertainment-wise, like duration?
Yeah. I mean, some, it kind of varies, but they tended to have like 4 to 6 plays a night, and some were as short as 20 minutes. Some of the comedies are. Sometimes they're sort of 35 to 40 minutes. And the economy of them is great, I think. And what I really admire about them, you know, and the skills of the writer, especially André Delorde was the kind of most prolific writer, was they could hit the ground running. And I think it's incredible. So a play begins, and if it was a normal play, you'd have had 2.5 acts before, you know, but they hit the ground running. The way the audience can immediately get the situation and get the backstory in time for the horrible denouement, you know, it's really, really quite incredible. And I think it's exciting, that kind of anthology package. But, you know, that became a great horror tradition, of course, didn't it? The portmanteau, or the short story, really.
Mm-hmm. I'm a big fan of Amicus and Hammer. Mostly Amicus does the anthologies, but, you know, just I have a large collection of anthology horror movies. And although it's interesting, there's sort of a weird tie-in I keep thinking about. That William Castle definitely used the exact same kinds of marketing as the Grand Guignol. And he also made a movie called The Nightwalker, which was written by Robert Bloch. And Robert Bloch made a movie for Amicus that was called The Terror Garden, which is the name of a play from the Grand Guignol. So I wonder how aware Castle and Bloch were of this horror tradition.
Yeah, I think one of these fascinating things, isn't it? You know, how much was known about it. Did these people go there? Probably not. And yet they were aware of its reputation. Another one is Alfred Hitchcock. Now, Hitchcock, I know, was going to the theatre a lot in London in the early 20s. You know, before he got into the film industry. And, of course, there was an experiment in London of the Grand Guignol. So there's a strong chance Hitchcock was there, you know. And a lot of his work is Grand Guignolian. You know, Hitchcock was not interested in the supernatural, but he was great at making horror. Mm-hmm. It's there. I think also it did have a reputation. There's a couple of the old Tales from the Crypt comics from the 50s that are about the Grand Guignol. So whether some of those, the writers or artists of that had been to the Grand Guignol when they were GIs in the war, I don't know, you know, or had they read about it and the kind of coverage it had, because it did have this kind of status, it kind of embeds itself. And it's such an irresistible idea, I think. If you're at all interested in horror, how can you not be interested in the idea of a horror theatre? So I think it kind of embeds itself, you know. And as you say, William Castle is doing a lot of those tricks with the life insurance salesman and you know, those kind of things. And it was the same with, you know, the early screenings of Psycho, wasn't it? I mean, Hitchcock was doing the same kind of thing, you know. And I think, they're probably aware of the Grand Guignol. I mean, also, the other thing worth saying is, you know, the French cinema as well, films like Les Diaboliques, Eyes Without Face. I mean, these are incredibly pioneering films, and Hitchcock owes a lot to Les Diaboliques. I don't think there's any question. You know, it doesn't have a shower scene, but it has one of the greatest horror bathrooms.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
And Les Diaboliques absolutely would be aware of the Grand Guignol, because it was alive and kicking there, you know, down the road in Montmartre.
Well, and Eyes Without a Face, that, oh my goodness. In one sense, you're definitely not seeing something, yet you feel like you're seeing something far worse. Incredible film. So
Richard, you've mentioned Delorde and how prolific he was with his plays. Could you talk a little bit about some of the playwrights and the authors, and also some of the famous actors that performed there?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I mean, what was fascinating with Delorde, I mean, he was prolific. He was the Prince of Terror. You know, what a great name to have. So he was producing loads of stuff, often working with people because he wanted to get his facts right. So he would work with psychologists. You know, if it was a play about a lunatic asylum or an escaped madman or whatever, you know, he would sometimes co-write these. he was working with experts, medical experts as well, to make sure he was getting the medical terminology or surgery sequences correct for the time. Mm-hmm. And that's interesting. Another writer, you know, they did attract some famous writers, and one was Maurice Renard, you know, a great science fiction writer. And he wrote for the Grand Guignol. He wrote a play called The Lover of Death, which was about hypnosis. And, you know, we look at it now and think, oh, yeah, it's a very Svengali kind of play. But when you look at the time, what was going on in Paris or France was huge debates amongst psychologists about the ethics of hypnosis. And then we've got a living, breathing horror play that shows the perils of hypnosis. So right. You have people like that. Yeah, so lots of people involved in that. Octave Mirbeau, really wonderful French writer. You know, he wrote a couple of plays for the Grand Guignol. Yeah, I mean, you know, it just had this kind of appeal. Gaston Leroux, who wrote Phantom of the Opera, wrote a horror play for the Grand Guignol. You know, so it had this pull. And they also had, the great era of the 20s and that. They had actors like Paula Maxer, you know, known as the most assassinated woman in the world. And she was the original Scream Queen, really. But what's fantastic with her, yes, she was the victim, but there were plays where she was the perpetrator as well. And I just think that must have been so wonderful for the audience, you know, seeing her, you know, with the stage blood as she's chopped to pieces or whatever. 20 minutes later, she's back on stage doing it to somebody else. You know, great.
That's fantastic. She sort of seeing how these people, you know, tried their careers spanned the sort of like the peak of the theater, and they had to like, you know, they spun off in their own directions, but used it as an inspiration. It seems like the footprint, the cultural footprint of this little format venue is quite a bit outsized.
Yeah, absolutely. It's quite remarkable in that way, isn't it? Yeah, definitely. Just to go back to Hitchcock for a moment, you know, there's a film Torn Curtain, and the Paul Newman one, and it's not the greatest of Hitchcock's films, but there's an amazing sequence where they have to kill a Stasi agent in silence. Because if they do it noisily, you know, his co-worker outside will hear. And it's just this amazing kind of 10, 15-minute sequence of how do you kill someone in silence.
Wow.
And it's like a short Grand Guignol play in its own right. And again, I think Hitchcock, you know, inherently knew that structure and what you could do with the structure, you know.
That's why if I have to be quiet, I only murder mimes. That's my trick.
Yeah. So with so many people being tortured and butchered and stabbed and killed over the years, I've heard that there were some injuries that took place over time and that two people died. Do you know anything about those kinds of cases of injuries and deaths?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a really important thing. Again, when I'm talking to young actors or something, I will warn them about this, that it's not an improvisation form, right?
Right.
You know, maybe when you're spitballing an idea, great fun. But as soon as you're getting things on its feet, you've got to be so disciplined. And it's, you know, stage violence is very big in the Grand Guignol, but it's like all stage fighting. It's choreographed like ballet. You know, you do not take chances with it. And, you know, you learn the moves so you can do those, you know, without overthinking it. You know, you can do them perfectly and slickly and safely. And we still hear about it. You know, occasionally, every few years, there'll be like a retracting blade that didn't retract. People getting stabbed and injured on stage. And it's probably just like a discipline. And, you know, I'm afraid there's been a horrible story in the States this week.
Right. Yeah, just thinking about that ourselves.
Yeah. You know, safety is so important. So, you know, if you're in the case of the Grand Guignol, make sure there's blanks in the gun. Make sure it is a retracting blade, you know, and make sure the performers know how to handle those very, very carefully.
It seemed from my reading that rehearsals were extensive and brutal to prepare for these shows. So, I think a lot of times when you go to see a performance, especially if it's a new one, you might expect some mistakes and problems. But it sounds like even though they're performing so many different shows, that this troupe was incredibly well trained.
Yeah, that's it. And it's amazing. You know, Paula Max wrote some very, unfortunately, quite short memoirs, but we get a snapshot. And she says how demanding it was, how exhausting it was, partly because of those scenes of violence, which had to be done safely and yet convincingly. And that's the thing, isn't it? You know, if someone's stabbing you, but, you know, if you sat at a certain angle, you said that blade came nowhere near them. You know, it begins to collapse a bit. So it had to be really slick and good. But she also said about working with the audience, because sometimes if things went a bit wrong and the audience started laughing in the wrong way, there's the right kind of laughter for a horror show, I think, but laughing in the wrong way begins to destroy the show. And she said it was really tough to get back on the tightrope. You know, that's how she compared it, because, you know, taking the audience with you, as you guys were saying earlier, it's not real. You know, and the audience is sat there thinking, knowing really it's not real, but they suspend their disbelief and go with it. But, you know, if that begins to collapse a bit, it becomes silly and everyone laughs at it. And, you know, they didn't want that. They did want to keep people on the tightrope with them.
Well, you remind me of an interesting sort of procedural question. For doing your research, you know, I know you could look at reviews in the newspaper, but how does one gauge how the average audience member saw something like this? Like, do we have any access to what the general public, rather than these sort of, you know, media people, were thinking about what they saw here?
No, I think unfortunately that's the kind of challenge we faced. You know, and if you had a time machine, I mean, that you'd be on the list, wouldn't it? And talking to the audience, not least. So we get the odd snapshot. There's the odd account that does come up from people who were there. The odd memoir can be quite surprising. There's also some reviews. Yeah, they may be exclusively about what's on the stage. But there's a fascinating one about the London experiment, I remember, where the reviewer was talking about the audience. And he got a bit freaked because he said there's lots of young people who've got a kind of macabre fascination in this stuff. And, of course, this was just a couple of years after the First World War. And he was really intrigued by why there were young men and women going to the theatre by themselves and just sat there with a grin on their face watching these horror shows. So you get the odd snapshot. And, I mean, they sound great, guys, don't they?
Yeah. Well, they're probably my people. So
yeah, exactly.
This episode of Monster Talk is brought to you by Manscaped. Let's take a moment and talk about a serious problem affecting many people around the world, including listeners like you. It's a growing problem that you may be all too aware of, or perhaps it afflicts someone you love. Are your nether regions a sweaty, hairy, or dare I say it, a blurry mess? If so, you may be suffering from
squatch crotch.
Well, have no fear. The thoughtful ball grooming engineers at Manscaped have got just the solution for you. There's a vast difference between these specially crafted instruments and the cheap clippers you see at the store. You might even say these products define their own classification of genitools. Don't bungle your jungle. Trust Manscaped, skin-safe devices for this critical work. Now, have these products been checked for safety? Yes, they have, and I'm proud to say I'm one of their testees. Get shorn with surety. Get cropped with confidence. Try Manscaped's Performance Package 4.0, the performance package for your package. And you can try it with free shipping plus 20% off your order by going to manscaped.com and using the code MONSTER at checkout. The Performance Package 4.0 comes with the Lawnmower 4.0 Trimmer, the Weed Whacker Ear and Nose Hair Trimmer, Crop Preserver Ball Deodorant, Crop Reviver Toner, Performance Boxer Briefs, plus a travel bag to hold your goodies. Why is it travel bag and not travel sack? I don't know. Anyway, what does all this mean? It starts with the Lawnmower 4.0 Trimmer, the fourth generation rechargeable trimmer engineered to cut your hair, not your skin. It has a 7,000 RPM motor. It has a 4,000K LED spotlight, so you can see clearly what you're doing down there. It's got a really comfortable rubberized grip, and it charges in a stylish USB base station. Plus, it's waterproof up to a meter, so you can tidy up in the shower or even in the bath. You don't need a physics course to understand how the Lawnmower 4.0 does work with your jewels. Hey, but wait, there's more! The Weed Whacker is designed to trim hair in your ears and nose. And as I get older, I find I'm sprouting hairs in place I do not want hairs. With the Weed Whacker trimmer, I can quickly return my ears and nose to their glory days. And I get to do it with some badass technology in the form of a 9,000 RPM motor and 360-degree rotary blade system, all implemented with Manscaped's skin-safe system. Shear without fear. Hey, their machines are great, but you also get the Crop Preserver and Crop Reviver Toner, too. These soothing formulas will finish off your grooming with comfort and a fresh, clean scent. Maybe you don't care how you smell down there, but these products also leave you feeling fresh and clean. So even if nobody else knows what's going on down there, you'll be making good scents. And I'll tell you one more thing. Not only can Manscaped help you stop Squatch Crotch, but the Lawnmower 4.0 also does an incredible job of tackling back hair. From your sagittal crest all the way down to Ape Canyon, the SkinSafe system will clear your backwoods. Now, I'm a very hairy dude, with size 14 shoes. But thanks to Manscaped, just because I'm built like a Bigfoot doesn't mean I have to look like one. Manscaped even threw in two free gifts for their Performance Package 4.0, the Manscaped Boxers and the Shed Travel Bag. The boxers are comfy, the bag is gorgeous and roomy, and they're free with this offer. Join the 2 million men worldwide who trust Manscaped. Get the new Performance Package 4.0 by going to manscaped.com for 20% off plus free shipping with the code MONSTER. That's manscaped.com with the code MONSTER to get 20% off plus free shipping.
I knowed it was a Sasquatch from her suit.
I think it's fascinating because when we think of Paris, especially in Australia or in America, we think of it being one of the most sophisticated and cosmopolitan cultural cities in the world. And there's a kind of tacky side to Grand Guignol, and yet it was just one of the most popular attractions of its day. So in any way, was it considered to be out of place, or was this just really embraced by the country and by the city?
Yeah, I think it was part of that thing. You know, it's the French thing, isn't it, of l'amour and l'amour, love and death, and very, very closely linked. They almost sound the same in French. And
yeah,
it was part of that. I think there was an ownership of the Grand Guignol by Montmartre. You know, they were very proud of it for many years. It became a bit more complicated towards the end, unfortunately. But for many years, they were very proud of what it was and its uniqueness. There were attempts to imitate it across the world. You know, London was quite a successful attempt. So there was an allure there. And I think one thing that's fascinating with Paris is, there's the Eiffel Tower, the Arc de Triomphe, the Louvre and all of those things. But there is also the catacombs. There is also the subway, the metro. There's also pornography, erotica culture, so important in Parisian culture. And there's also the Grand Guignol. So there's something there. And you have writers like Colette, you know, wonderful French writer, you know, real woman of letters and that, saying how much she loved mm-hmm. the Grand Guignol. You know, she loved that little mm-hmm. place. And she wished there was more, I nearly swore then, there was more sex than violence, but she put it more
poetically. You can swear on this show.
But there were some, and she loved it for that. And so it's part of the package of Paris, which is one of the great Gothic cities, after all. It is Phantom of the Opera, it is Quasimodo, and it is the Grand Guignol.
Somehow we didn't talk about the name itself, this Grand Guignol.
Oh, yeah.
It means with giant puppet, is that right? Or large puppet,
big puppet.
Yeah, because the guignol, and if you just look up guignol, you know, you'll find kind of images of toy puppets and what in the UK we'd call Punch and Judy, that kind of tradition. Mm. So it was like a Punch and Judy show for adults, or, you know, toy puppet show for grown-ups. So that summed it up. Also, the guignol was sometimes a slang for a green room, dressing room. And the whole theatre was so tiny, it was called like the big dressing room, you know. So there's a few sort of things that underpin it. But it, I mean, in the end, it ends up being such a wonderful term, you know. But I think that the big puppet show is a nice idea.
It is interesting. It reminds me of like there's, if you said that name, maybe the people at the time would know you're making references to these sort of shows. Whereas now I don't, especially coming from French to English, it's not as obvious to me, you know, what it means. But I'm fascinated by the way things like the characters from, and I'll probably mess this up too, the Commedia dell'arte. I'm one of those people who reads things but doesn't necessarily hear them. And Reynard the Fox and those sort of stock character like Chanticleer. Like all these sort of like medieval and 16th, 1700s, theater traditions where some of it was improvisational and we have the characters, but we don't have the plays. You know, I'm fascinated by how these sort of provide this sort of like genetic material for ongoing artistry without necessarily being able to go back and say, here was what it was originally and here's what it is now.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
It's so interesting. Yeah,
it is. The other thing worth mentioning, perhaps, with the Grand Guignol, there were rivals.
Oh.
There's one theatre called the Theatre of Two Masks. And obviously, you know, the masks were tragedy and comedy or whatever.
Yeah.
And it did try the same thing. So it did have the hot and cold shower. So there was that. So, you know, there were other ones that, you know, the formula was so successful. Other places kind of imitated it. But I think what they didn't have was that venue. You know, they didn't have a deconsecrated chapel. They didn't have the... You know, so there was one short-lived thing in the 20s in the Paris Wax Museum. They actually built a theatre inside to do kind of horror shows. It was a bit short-lived, but, you know, they're all trying to say, wow, we want a bit of that money. The people who couldn't get into the Grand Guignol, we want them to come to us.
But, Richard, you mentioned Colette being a fan of the theatre. And I've also read that a number of celebrities and other famous people visited the theatre, like Ho Chi Minh and Anas Nin. Could you tell us a little bit about some of the people who would attend these shows, some of the celebrities and stars?
Yeah, I mean, that's it. They had, you know, I think General Patton went to see the Grand Guignol, you know, on the liberation of France, you know, so really fascinating idea that, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, it was just so popular, so many people would go. But I think what's important to remember is, yeah, you did have that local audience, you know, the locals who owned the theatre would see shows again and again, you know. You had that as well as the tourists coming in. But, you know, it seems like we're trying to piece this together, myself and Mike Wilson, but it seems like Agatha Christie went to the Grand Guignol because we found evidence that she was writing short horror plays around the time she went to Paris. So, you know, maybe we'll find a letter. Maybe there'll be something that proves that. But, you know, these people going over, and it's just a lovely thought, isn't it, that they're like, I'll go and see that. I'll check that out.
Yeah. So the in crowd.
Yes.
Now,
but this is one thing of quite a serious note, though, in terms of people going to see it. During World War II, the Grand Guignol stayed open. Now, a lot of the Parisian theatres closed. The Grand Guignol made the decision to stay open and was very popular with the occupying Germans. And this really became a bit difficult for the reputation. I think a lot of the local audience were very resentful. Because the horrors that were going on in real life and then people going to watch the horrors on the Grand Guignol stage and the people who are watching it, you know, were the occupying forces. And you can just see that is going to perhaps leave a bit of a bitter taste in your mouth.
Yeah.
I've heard that some of the actors were actually members of the French Resistance.
Exactly.
And they had people like Hermann Göring visiting and watching the performances, and could have turned out interesting.
Yeah, that's it. You can imagine Hermann Göring laughing loudly and, you know, clapping and in admiration of the blood effects and everything. Yeah, it's a very problematic part of the theatre's history, I think.
Yeah. Do they have to, like, get endorsed by the Vichy or whoever was in charge?
Yeah, I mean, as I was saying, you know, some closed and, you know, some people left France if they could and so on. But the Grand Guignol, it seems like, had quite a successful few years during that time. You know, so, yeah, it's part of the tragedy of it, I think, in a way, you know.
Yeah, yeah. But I'd also heard the comment that when they eventually closed, there was the quote by Charles Noonan that we could never equal Buchenwald, but yet they did survive into the 60s. That's a long time. Many businesses don't make it an additional 20 years. You know what I mean? Saying that, you know, tying their closure to, you know, the horrors of the real world, I don't know. It might be more of a transactional, you know, economics thing. I don't know. Maybe you know more about why they got a business, right?
Yeah, I think it's part of popular culture history, isn't it? I think what happened was the rise of TV and the rise of more liberated cinema. You know, when Hitchcock and Psycho can show a toilet for the first time on the screen and a shower scene and all of these things with the glory of editing and so on, and Diabolique could do what it could do. Maybe the demographic shifted. Maybe young people wanting a good night out say, let's go to the movies. There's a great horror movie, rather than let's go to the dear old Grand Guignol. So I think that was really impactful. And, you know, I think that's the same. That's a similar story for a lot of theatre. There's huge shifts and changes happening in theatre post-war. And that's a lot of it is, you know, the audience is elsewhere suddenly, perhaps, you know. And also the Grand Guignol in its last days, it was run by a guy called Eddie Gillane, who really did try to keep it going. And he did some great things, you know, did a sort of stage version of Eyes Without a Face. You know, he adapted that to the stage.
Wow.
But he was also doing some things that were very, very violent. And there's one play where a woman stripped naked and her nipples are cut off with scissors. And okay, you know, this is the Grand Guignol. They've never done that before. You know, they're outdoing themselves. But yeah, maybe for some people it's like, yeah, maybe this is going too far. Maybe this is just on the edge now. I think I'll go to the movies instead.
Yeah. So I guess we're kind of running out of time. So let's sort of, what happens at the end? Like, how does this, I guess what I want to know is, when it shuts down, what's the lasting impact of it? Like how, I mean, I know I'm still hearing about it and I can't stop thinking about it. So,
yeah. Well, it's interesting. Yeah. It closes down. They strip out the inside. So those wonderful angels go forever and all of that. It's all stripped outside. Mm. The facade is still there and it's still a theater, even though inside the layout's completely different, but the facade is still there. And for me, that's a bit of a metaphor. So even though they closed it down, it still remains as a theatre. The building is still there. But also that long shadow of influence, you know, it's continued to fascinate us. You know, as time goes by, there's very few people left who actually saw the Grand Guignol, but it still haunts our memory. It still fascinates us. And it's a fantastic time, not talking about pandemic times, okay, but around that and now as we're emerging out of that, hopefully, it's a fantastic time for horror theatre. And so horror theatre's reviving of all kinds. There's some wonderful work out there, companies across the world. But also it's on our television screens, you know, with fantastic horror series and the horror movies at the cinema, you know, and let alone radio, let alone video games, whatever, board games, I don't know. Horror is everywhere. And often there's a little echo of the dear old Grand Guignol.
And has the tradition been revived somewhat? I've heard of some theatres, I think there's one in Washington, D.C. and one in San Francisco that produce plays that are similar to those which were shown at the Grand Guignol.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, in San Francisco, it's closed now, unfortunately, but for about 15 years, a guy called Russell Blackwood led Thrill Peddlers, which absolutely revived the tradition of the Grand Guignol. And they had their own theatre called the Hypnodrome, which had booths in it, you'll be pleased to hear. And they would do evenings of recreating old Grand Guignol plays, but also doing new works, also with burlesque floor shows. This whole wonderful package of popular theatre. Still with us is Molotov Theatre Company, which is based in Washington and also Baltimore. And they've evolved into the National Edgar Allan Poe Theatre, and they do magnificent work. The director of that is Alex Everstovich, who does wonderful work. And I've been fortunate enough to see some of their productions where they have created a night at the Grand Guignol, wonderful stuff, as well as doing some very, you know, modern pieces and modern takings, but still firmly horror theatre, but for the modern audience.
Right. And something to check out someday.
Definitely worth it, yeah. And in London at the moment, we've got the London Horror Festival, which is a whole range, so ranging from horror cabaret to horror magic and whatever. But, you know, often there'll be plays that the Grand Guignol would recognise, say, yeah, you owe us one for this, you know.
I have to say, I mean, I would love to go back to the theatre, and the idea of seeing something like this instead of Beckett really appeals to me. But not that there's anything wrong with Beckett, but we're waiting for Guignol. I'm going to mess up my own joke. Anyway, I wanted to say, though, you've got three volumes out about this topic, right? And right. I'll put a link to those in the show notes, but what else is coming up for Richard that people can find? What do you got in the books? What's next from you?
Yeah, well, great. Well, you'll be pleased to hear we got a fourth book coming out, Blake. When will we stop? a fourth collection. We're quite excited about this one because it intersperses some of the old plays which we're offering in translation for the first time, interspersed with horror company work now. And it's, you know, hopefully be really interesting for readers to see, you know, the kind of stuff that's being done now, including plays that are supernatural, but using that Guignol formula. So, you know, it's an exciting time for that. And for me, with my practice work last year, and so I've been doing a lot of radio drama, a lot of horror radio. So that's been enormous fun as well. So we've got some good stuff coming out there, hopefully. With your headphones on, frighten yourself silly.
Well, we'll definitely put a link to that in the show notes. I want to say again, thank you for helping us expand our audience's Grand Guignol knowledge. one more thing. I came across you initially by running into your lecture for the Miskatonic Institute of Horror Studies, and this is the second or third time that while prepping for the show, I've run across that site, and it's nowhere near me. But can you talk a little bit about what you know of that? I don't know what a practice, a group. I'm fascinated by everything they've done, but I don't know anything about them.
Yeah, it's an incredible kind of organization. So it's the Miskatonic Institute of Horror Studies. And, you know, it's not an academic-based thing. It sounds like it is, but the level of knowledge and passion that the people who participate in it is extraordinary. And I did a talk for the London branch, because there's branches all over. There's one in Los Angeles, New York, and London. I did one in London about the Grand Guignol in the old London Horse Hospital, which is the most extraordinary venue. And it was nice doing a talk, but you kind of wanted to do a whole Grand Guignol horror show in there, because the atmosphere was great, you know, and you'd hear the dead horses, no doubt, you know, neighing in disgust. so they do that. But they also do some interesting online stuff. I've actually got a talk coming up talking about horror radio with the LA branch. Mm-hmm. But I'm amazed the level of passion, the questions people ask. It's a wonderful organization. Yeah, you really, you know, do support them. Do get involved if you can.
I'll put a link to that in the show. Do you know when your talk is?
Yeah, it's an interesting one for me because it's this Tuesday. So it's very soon, actually.
Oh.
Probably too soon for your broadcast.
I can spread the link before the show comes out so that people can get that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's an interesting one for me because it's going to be 3:30 in the morning for me, but live for everybody in LA.
Wow. Oh. Wow. I guess it'll be lights out for you. Yeah.
Yes.
But you can record from your inner sanctum. It'll be great.
Yeah.
I'm terrible. Okay.
Well, Richard, you are. Richard, we've got a final question, our signature question for the show, and that is, what's your favorite monster?
Nice question. Well, I'll be enigmatic and I will say Mrs. Norma Bates.
Ooh, I like it.
Okay. I haven't had that one before.
And I assume all your fans know what I'm talking about.
I'm sure they do. Yes. Robert Block rears his head yet again. That's what's happening.
Yes.
I need to do more with him. I'm not sure, this particular show is, you know, typically more focused on monsters culturally, but I've got a podcast that I, a much neglected but beloved effort of trying to cover the topic of horror in general, and that probably would fit there. But Block produced so much work that I didn't realize was his, especially in the cinema, talking about those portmanteau films and that sort of stuff. But, you know, he's so much bigger than Psycho and has such an interesting history. I'd like to cover some of that.
The amazing thing is that friendship with H.P. Lovecraft, and then you look at the timeline, you think, surely not. But, you know, Block was a teenager, wasn't he? You had this correspondence with Lovecraft. And then, as you say, yeah, right through to the fantastic Amicus movies and TV writing. What a man. Yeah, amazing. Mm-hmm. Amazing.
Yeah, he's another person whose footprint is far larger than you would expect. It's very impressive stuff. So, well, thank you so very much for coming on to talk about this topic.
Thank you. It's absolutely fascinating. Crazy. And a great topic for Halloween as
well. Yeah, it really is. Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, and keep in touch too. It seems to me you'd be a great guest for future episodes.
Oh, thank you.
You know a lot.
Yeah. Well, I'd love it if, you know, I know we're different parts of the world, but imagine one day perhaps the three of us could sit together in a horror theater. Can you imagine?
Wouldn't that be grand?
Wonderful. Perfect.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
You just heard an interview with Professor Richard Hand. He's a professor of media practice at the University of East Anglia and co-author of multiple books about the topic of horror theater and the Grand Guignol in particular. His work on horror radio and other topics will also likely be of interest to our listeners, so please be sure and check out the show notes for links to all those. Monster Talk's a proud member of the Airwave Media Podcast Network, home of such shows as Big Picture Science, I Know What Scares You, and The Sit Down. If you'd like to advertise on this show, contact sales at advertisecast.com. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the very best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. We have links there to our Patreon page as well as a donation button. Another great way to support the show is to buy books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones, and we love Kindle so we can share our digital libraries with each other. And finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please share our show on your favorite social media platforms. Monster Talk's theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. Thanks so much for making our show part of your listening routine. Stay tuned. We've got lots more Monster Talk coming soon.
Been a Monster House presentation.
That's terrible.
Disgusting.